the one thought that runs through one's mind looking out on an audience like this is that Charles McDowell must be the speaker. Charlie McDowell has become an institution for many institutions, for the National Press Club, for the Gridiron Club, for a great many other bodies, but along the way he befriended at a very early stage the White Burkitt Miller Center and spoke at a time when not very many people knew anything about the Miller Center. So we remain forever indebted to him. All of you know that he's a graduate, first of all, of Washington and Lee, where his father was a professor, that he joined the Richmond Times-Dispatch as a writer in 1949, a Washington correspondent and columnist in 1965, that he's covered every presidential election since 1952, that he's the author of a number of books, Campaign Fever being one of them, a book on the Reagan presidency being another, and that he stars, especially for those who want sound, hard, factual interpretations of public affairs on Washington Week in Review. It's a great pleasure to have one of the nation's most outstanding journalists with us this evening. And Stage Blackford and I will ask a few questions, and then we hope the rest of you will join in after Charlie's opening remarks.
Thank you. Thank you, Ken. Hello. Gosh. I have this story I tell, and I tell it for me because it makes me feel all right standing up here. And not more than a fourth of you have heard it. Now, I wasn't going to tell it if there were less than 40 people. And I was going to tell another story, but now I'm going to tell my basic story to get over being scared of formidable audiences. I had been on Washington Week for 6 months before I was able to not just tremble. No one let on. The camera guys kept the camera up here, and they didn't know I was just acting. I just would freeze all afternoon before I went, and I would be bad. And then I got used enough to it, thanks to some of my colleagues leading me along, that I began to get cocky, and I decided I was probably a celebrity, and that I was drawing this wisdom to people. And I'm told later by Hedrick Smith and Duke and Haynes and a lot of others that I got a little bit insufferable. And I was pretty cocky. And then I got a letter from a lady in Niagara, New York, which I have memorized and tell every time I stand up. I tell my children when they come to dinner because it makes me feel all right. The lady in Niagara was 82, and there was a signature under hers that indicated her husband was 84, and it was a salutation in three lines. Salutation, dear Mr. McDonald. Which sort of straightens out celebrity. Line one, sometimes you don't seem to know exactly what the others are talking about on Washington Week in Review. Line two, neither do we. Line three, so having you there makes us feel better. And I feel better. Yesterday I went to lunch. This happens very rarely, but if you say it, and you're from Washington, if you say it casually enough, it's impressive. I went to lunch with Senator Mitchell, the majority leader of the Senate. So did 14 other reporters, and it wasn't like exclusive. And while we were standing at the place where the Perrier water is, that's the drink we serve in Washington, Senator Mitchell and I were staying there, and we didn't know each other very well, and we were talking, and there approached a distinguished Washington correspondent who I won't name, but he's famous, and he and Mitchell apparently had known each other since childhood or something, and the distinguished Washington correspondent said, I have a joke, And I thought, well, this is really be inside Washington stuff. Here's a great Washington correspondent, majority leader of the Senate. What kind of joke will they tell each other? I'll write a column about it. And the joke was told to the distinguished Washington correspondent by his 16-year-old daughter. And this is the latest Washington story. It has nothing to do with Washington. What do you have if you have an anorexic, insomniac, agnostic suffering from dyslexia? You have a thin guy lying in bed wondering if there is a dog. All right, now don't say that I never brought anything to Charlottesville. I thought I would try to talk some about George Bush and what everybody in Washington is talking about, which doesn't mean it's a real subject. It means it's a subject everybody in Washington is talking about. Of what kind of leader is George Bush? What kind of leader is he going to be? And does anybody know? Afterward, I would be on safer ground were anyone to ask such questions about Doug Wilder and Marshall Coleman and particularly the abortion issue and the Virginia race, quite apart from whatever happened with racism in that race. Love to talk about that and hear what y'all got to say about it or speculate on it. But for now, let me try Bush sort of from my own experience, in a sense. I nod to the latecomers. I don't know really where to start. I won't start the way I have the notes. The amazing thing about George Bush, while one is being perplexed by him, and I'm being quite perplexed by him, I just don't know what exactly he's doing. But there are some things I know, and I know them mostly from Democrats, because that's better testimony in this case. He's one of the most liked presidents that there's ever been, as far as I can tell. The genuine affection for him on the part of old Democratic leaders of Congress, not to mention old Republican leaders of Congress, people around town from the State Department to the Agriculture Department. George Bush is a terribly popular person. He is a very trusted person. He is a very knowledgeable person. Anyone who talks with him says how refreshing to talk to someone who's really up to the minute on issues, who understands the subtleties of issues, who is just about the best informed person about the American government. Now, given all that, and I'm skipping a whole lot of compliments for him, given all that, there is a general feeling in Washington that something's missing in his presidency. And there is a general suspicion, and when I say general, I mean it includes the leaders of the Republicans in the Senate, it includes members of his cabinet, it includes thoughtful people around town, including very conservative ones, that what is missing is a sense of leadership. But no one's willing to say it's not there. They say maybe it's too subtle for us. Well, maybe it'll show up in a minute. That's what's perplexing for everyone in the town. For me, and I'm not a student of George Bush, I've spent the last few weeks totally subconsciously, all the time, obsessed with what's happening in Eastern Europe, the Soviet Union. I don't think George Will is overstating when he says it's the greatest victory for liberty in the history of the world. Thoughtful people think that's overstating, but I don't think it's overstating. I think it's the most awesome, to use the kid's word, most remarkable period, I mean, certainly of my lifetime. And the collapse of the great enemy, the collapse of communism, came on such a vast scale, and it came so fast, and it came with such relative good humor that it just overwhelmed me. And when I would try to talk to real experts about it, it turned out they were overwhelmed in an enlightened way, but they were overwhelmed. As far as I can find out, there was only one human being in the world that was ahead of the curve, or at least up with the curve, and that was Gorbachev of the Soviet Union, who is not only responsible for a lot of it, but able to anticipate and make decisions and tell people in seven different countries, yield again, yield another piece, yield it all. Who else has kept up with it? Our whole country, I think, fails to perceive it. How massive it is. And here's where I felt this absence. I haven't had a president who would come on the television or the radio for a fireside chat or somewhere and talk to me about it. I didn't want a press conference with George Bush. I didn't want him to do anything special. I wanted a sense of national celebration and concern. And I even wanted somebody to say, and there are a lot of hard curves to make down the road, but I wanted to have discussed with me the end of 40 years of a collision and a freeze in the world that we've had nothing like in my time. And he never came on and he never made that talk. Was a little thing at Thanksgiving that didn't quite do it. A Roosevelt would have done it, Eisenhower would have done it, Nixon would have done it, and we wouldn't have had to love him while he did it, but he would have done it. And he would have had something to say to us, and that worries me. It fits, I'm told, in this specific case, into the George Bush pattern of prudence, caution, consultation, 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 decision to be more prudent, prudence to show more caution. This is a cautious man and a careful man, and he hasn't varied from that since first day. I realized the other day, somewhat irrelevant, I mean, somewhat disrespectfully, I suppose, that all the arguments I was hearing about George Bush, and again, the ones I credit are from conservatives who like him and want him to succeed, what I realized was all the arguments about him are whether the fact that he doesn't do much is good or bad. But the given is that he doesn't do much. And then they say, well, see, not doing much was exactly right in this case. And not doing much in this case was a little bit wrong, but it wasn't as wrong as if he'd done something. But we talk about that he doesn't do anything much, but caretake, consult, advise, stay in touch. I have some quotes on George Bush. These are from people, three people that I don't particularly know, but I respect. One says this of the White House: they're cautious where they ought to be bold, and bold where they ought to be cautious. That's Mickey Edwards of Oklahoma, chairman of the House Republican Policy Committee, talking about the White House. Next quote from a member of Congress. You go out there thinking you're doing their bidding down at the White House, and you fall on your sword, and they're in the back room cutting a new deal. That's Senator Malcolm Wallop, a very conservative Republican from Wyoming. The third, we are not wrestling with the budget and with America's role in a changing world. We are being governed by inertia. That's John Danforth, Republican senator from Missouri, and a Bush loyalist and close personal friend. That's why I also am concerned. I'll finish quick. The deficit, Bush says that's up to Congress to fix. He has not submitted any comprehensive plan for reduction of the deficit, and there's none forthcoming. He has sent his brilliant budget man, Darman, to work with very slick congressmen in faking the revenue figures, which Reagan did for 8 years and which Democrats have done in history, just not at this volume. But we fake the revenue figures and predict enough income that we don't let Graham Rudman shut down the government. And the Democrats go right along with the fakery, so there's no heroes in this matter. So the deficit's up to Congress, he says. He says we must have a new space program, renew the faith of John Kennedy and everybody else, and have a space program and go to Mars, but then no funds. But we're going to have the program, we just don't have any money for it. We have a new housing program that has everything in it but any money. We have an education program from the education president who said he had to do something about it, and he came to Charlottesville for very constructive talk about it. And his first year's request for education was somewhat less than Reagan's last request for education. Now that's been beefed up just a little bit. There isn't any money. Drug war, that's the biggest thing we've ever undertaken on the domestic side, apparently, and when you really look at it, what will be added to it by the end of the fiscal, but was to have been added to it by the end of this fiscal year, it'll actually go well into the next one. The total addition was $2.2 billion. $2.2 billion, contrary to Everett Dirksen's notion, if you talk about billion, $2 billion, $3 billion, pretty soon you talk about real money. That isn't real money in Washington anymore. $2.2 billion will buy four stealth bombers, just to name a weapon at random. It's not really a very big investment we're making in the drug war from the federal state. Nuclear cleanup will cost $100 billion. That's to clean up the plants the government runs on contract to private industry. Private industry not only stole the government blind in some of those plants, but just dumped its atomic waste against the government's own rules. And the taxpayers are going to go for about $100 billion to pay for that over a decade. Capital gains tax, on again, now off again, and a deal to be struck with the Democrats about it probably in the end. The environment, where he appointed a brilliant environmental leader who he loves, Mr. Riley. The administration has most recently given ground on its Clean Air Act, which was to be a very strong one. Now it's down to being a moderately strong one. That's better than none, but he's given a lot of ground on it. And the global warming thing that we took the lead in bringing international leading scientists and government together in Europe recently, our guy was instructed at the last minute that we didn't want to go on with the program, that we wanted to withdraw and study it again. And that's gone on a lot. Aid to Poland was so embarrassing that in its small amount, and to Hungary, that Republican members of the Congress worked around behind the backs of the White House and talked to White House aides who said, yes, we got to get it up. And so Congress doubled all that aid. And we'll probably triple it. But that wasn't George Bush. What we've had is, I call it unfunded rhetoric from the president. And some of the rhetoric's right on the mark. And his identification of the problems is perfectly astonishing. He says our principal problems in the country are education, child care, health care, the environment, and the drug war. And when he talks about it with small delegations from Congress, he says he's the best talker about it in the United States, that he really has ideas for programs, that he really gives a damn, that he's isolated what's the strong and the weak points of the assorted program, but says we got no money. And we don't have any money. The government is broke. I said a minute ago I'd quit. I really will quit in 2 minutes. The question then arises, how does the public react to all this? And my private theory is that the country at large reacts positively, that it likes unfunded rhetoric, that it really likes to hear what our main problems are and that we've got to do something about them. but we don't have to pay any taxes, any additional taxes, and somehow it'll be all right. George Bush's 70% popularity rating is higher than Reagan's ever was, except right after he was shot, when he was a legitimate American hero. I think the public's come to like divided government, and I think George Bush loves divided government, which I'd love to talk to you about later. I think he's a coalitionist, really a coalitionist, and that's his idea of a good place is where you have a balance, so nobody can do much, but you can run it well. Divided government, Republicans won 5 out of the last 6 presidential elections, 7 out of the last 10. American people are going to vote Republican, I think, right along, unless something very strange happens for president. And the Democrats have dominated the Congress for 40 years, and the domination gets larger and larger. Half the Democrats elected in the past election to both the House and Senate were elected from districts George Bush carried. I mean, these were very conscious, these deciding voters knew exactly what they were doing, and they did it. As I said, my theory is that Bush likes coalition government, that he feels like he works well in it, that he feels like it's the natural transition from Reagan conservatism, which was much too conservative for George Bush, as I read his history and have tried to study a little bit about him. He figures a coalition government in which he sort of sticks up for some symbols, all those constitutional amendments. Don't burn the, flag burning, abortion, a balanced budget, line item veto, all those things. He considers, okay, throw that out there for the zealots on the right, and we'll run a nice moderate coalition here with those Democrats, and it'll come out all right. Problem is they need money, and we're not able to do anything about a lot of things. I've come to the end, except to say that we just have problems piling up. We have a little bright spot here. We're going to be able to reduce defense. It's going to make some money available toward the middle of the decade. And in the end of the decade, maybe a lot of money available for these social concerns and other concerns that Bush so correctly identifies. Whether we're going to wait in this richest of all countries, I don't guess the Japanese are richer than we are yet, but the wealth that we have is so amazing, and we have these real problems, and we're apparently going to have to wait for the defense budget to decline to find money. I'll end on a Ronald Reagan. I heard him make a speech at the height of his power, and incidentally, I've got Ronald Reagan's Gridiron Club speech here, which if anyone gets awfully wounded about my not being very kind to George Bush, ask me during the question period to give you some relief with a Reagan joke or two. This one is just one I remember because I said we got problems. Reagan was speaking to the Alfalfa Club, which is sort of the military-industrial complex assembled in Washington with newspaper publishers added for some zest that I don't understand. And I was a guest, and I loved it. But Reagan had just reduced our taxes sharply and doubled our defense budget, and we were going to crank up industry so big we wouldn't need any new taxes. It'd be such a flow of money that we'd be over just swimming in revenue. It was all going to be wonderful. And everything he said, everyone cheered. He was the hero. You never saw such a hero. And all these people in their black tie and all, and they would just cheer. No matter what said, they'd cheer. And the old man began to realize it was ridiculous that they were cheering too much. And he said, wait a minute. And the room had not heard that tone from him. And he said, it isn't that we don't have problems. I'm out to dinner making a speech, and I didn't want to tell you about the problems. But don't get carried away. We got real problems in this country. Well, the audience became quite sad and dismayed. And Reagan, who has instant rapport with that, thought, oops, I pushed him too far, and I got to cheer him back up. So he said, you're very fortunate that I am your president because it's no problem I can't solve. And they laughed about like that, thinking, what's wrong with him now? And he said, actually, I can solve the greatest problem in the world, and therefore I figure I can solve any of the rest. I know how to catch a porcupine. And everyone. And he said, I'll tell you how you catch one. It's the hardest thing in the world, but there's a solution that's not that difficult. You throw a tub over it, big tub, just throw it right over it, And that gives you some place to sit down while you figure out what in the hell to do next. I think that's where we are. Thank you very much.
We'll ask a couple of questions, and then the better questions can come from the floor. You wrote a column yesterday in which you quoted the majority leader as saying that the president ought to take the initiative. Where does that leave the majority party in that Senate and the House?
George Mitchell thinks, and I think to some degree Tom Foley agrees with him, that being the majority party in the House requires you to stand up for the presidency more than you would even otherwise. That you must defer to the president, but more than to take the initiative on things. There are catches in this. You must defer, and if the president still doesn't lead, you put heat on him to lead. And if he still doesn't take initiatives, you try to embarrass him into taking the lead. Maybe that does you some political good, but I don't think that's what Mitchell means when he says it, because he's such a straight guy. He just says you can't have two presidents, one in the Capitol. He says he knows Democrats all over America think there ought to be two presidents. One in the White House and one up at the Capitol. And that would be the Democratic president. And they'd have programs and new initiatives all the time. Mitchell says it doesn't work, that the Constitution wasn't set up for it and the government doesn't work that way. That you have got to press the president politically and otherwise to take initiatives, and then Congress do what it's supposed to do, revise them, double the size of them, reduce them, kill them, but that the country doesn't work unless the president takes the lead. And I think that's interesting. I'm not sure how I evaluate it, but I think it's interesting because it's Mitchell who said it. And after a period of Robert Byrd's sort of good-hearted, partisan, detailed parliamentarianism, the Democrats suddenly have a very striking leader in the Senate. And if you watch him on television, you're going to see why polls and things are beginning to show that the Democrats' image in the Senate has improved greatly. We have a distinguished federal judge with the liveliest possible mind leading the Democrats in the Senate. And he has a unflamboyant, non-political kind of flair. He works terrifically well with Robert Dole, who's a big league political leader. And the two together are beginning to lift the Senate. Meanwhile, in the House, there has come the remarkable Tom Foley, who has style and grace and great humor and great dedication and a very little D Democratic mood that allows him to spend some lunches eating with Republicans mostly. He and the Republican leader have become very close already, and the difference between him and Jim Wright is just striking. And the Democrats look good on Capitol Hill. They really look good. And they're working more closely with Republicans than at any time since early Jimmy Carter. And Capitol Hill's a pretty interesting place. It's trapped in no money, and it's trapped in gimmicks to pretend that we aren't broke. But it's in human terms, it's a very encouraging place. I gave a long answer to it. Good question. I don't think I ever answered.
Well, Charlie, from all you've said, you make me hope that Bismarck was right when he said there's a special providence in paradise for drunkards, fools, and Americans. But which brings up the question that...
I don't think we have a speaker, so you just...
I just have to speak up. I'm sorry, I'm a little low. From what you said, it sounds to me like Bush is a kind of a follow-me leader rather than a get-out-in-front-of-the-crowd leader. And I just wonder, is any chance that he ever made rise to a Churchillian plateau and tell us we got nothing to speak for but blood, toil, sweat, and tears? In other words, is he ever going to say, is there going to be an increase in taxes? Because from what you've said, it seems to me that's the only alternative.
When we finish cleaning up. What was the question? The question was, is George Bush ever going to burst out into Churchillian leadership and or say, hey, we got to raise some money for taxes? A lot of Democrats in the Congress and around Washington thought that time would come, and that it would come through the very close negotiations of Republican and Democratic leaders and the White House, and it would come in terms of some special tax on oil, and then maybe a special tax here and a special tax there, and we'd get some revenue in. I'm not sure about that now, because we have the at first illusory and ultimately real possibility of defense cuts on a very large order. And when Dick Cheney at the Pentagon is talking about $180 billion in cuts in defense over a 3 to 4 year period beginning 1992, you're talking enough money to fund new child care and health and all those programs. So there'll be, I think, maybe stage an increasing temptation to stall it out until this marvelous defense pile of money comes. I'm not sure, and let us all be square. In Washington, we talk about a cut. We don't ever mean a cut from present level of appropriations. We mean a cut from the projected level of appropriations. And it's probably, they argue to me that that's more real than the way I would do it. But they say, no, that's reality. The population expands, the revenue expands, it's okay. But I suspect that we're heading into 2-3 more years of, let's see, of our health program. Our health programs for poor people leaves out about a fifth of the American population of having any medical coverage at all. We have the highest infant mortality rate in the industrial world, and we're getting down there among the emerging third world countries on that one. We have 20% of our population in poverty. We finally agreed that to break the welfare cycle, you've got to deal with single mothers. And the most hopeful adventurous programs that have gotten into that say that if you can provide child care for that mother, she can go to training school and will work. But we got no money for the child care programs. And on in this rich country, just one thing after another that, quite apart from ingenuity, would seem to need a little money. There's no one that's disagreeing strongly with that that's close to the government. Bob Dole's had 3 tax increase bills he's signed in the past 3 years. And he can't get it off the ground. He's a conservative proponent. There are plenty of votes for some new revenue in the House by Republicans. But everyone's intimidated by us voters, and maybe that's what the founding fathers had in mind, that we'd be intimidated by voters. I guess it's not a real bad thing to say. But the perception is that the voters don't think you need to raise taxes, that the money's there somewhere. It's just all those politicians dickering with it, and if you get rid of the corruption or the bureaucracy or the something, there's plenty of money there. I don't happen to believe that, but a lot of people want to believe that, do believe that. Bush is addressing these problems, and we're aware of them, and we're going to give more to charity next year, and we don't need to raise taxes. I think we need to raise taxes, but no one cares about that.
Let me ask you just one more.
What do you think about the argument that all presidents, not George Bush by any means alone, go on the road when after a 6 months or a year or 18 months they find that domestic problems are insoluble and foreign policy initiatives bring great popularity and show that you're a leader? Isn't it true that after the NATO conference, wasn't it last spring, Bush's popularity, in some groups anyway, skyrocketed? And what do you think about the theory that that he'll emerge as a foreign policy leader over the years?
Well, I think the question says the answer. I think Ken's simply right, as he tends to be in that field. I pretend he's not necessarily right in all fields, but he's right about that one. It seems to me George Bush would like to be a foreign policy leader. That's his basic interest. That's what he's kept up with no matter what he was doing. He's probably the only leader in the world who can pick up the phone and talk personally to 40 other leaders and know them well enough that it's not presumptuous and it makes nobody self-conscious, that he simply calls Miss Thatcher or he calls whoever in any country, calls Gorbachev, talks to Gorbachev's assistants. This man is into foreign policy, understands it, is comfortable with it, likes it very much. Don't know whether he's very decisive about it, but he's into it. And in the United States, nothing lifts our hearts more than to see our president on tour of foreign lands, meeting with people. The meeting with Gorbachev will be, that was going to be a put your feet up and talk session, incidentally. And Bush very cautiously said that there would be no real substance. This was to really get to know each other better, and then they'd go back for the big one later. Well, that's come around. It's going to be very full of substance. And it will be major, and it will deal with the whole future of Eastern Europe. And simultaneously, Western Europe, which is coming into union while we're preoccupied with Eastern Europe, we're 2 years away from the great economic union that's been an impossible dream for a century. And what's going on in the Soviet Union, and what kind of help does the Soviet Union need? Aren't we finally through suspecting that Gorbachev is faking us? Having thrown away five communist countries in the last 6 or 8 weeks, it's a hell of a fake. aren't we finally coming to the point that we're ready to talk about what can we do to get some food in your markets so you hold on? That doesn't seem to me a disgraceful thing for Bush to be prepared to talk about, and I feel sure he's prepared to talk about it. In terms of the polls, up they'll go. Yes, our presidents have always run for foreign lands when things are bad at home, and their polls tend to go up when they get abroad and represent the flag and their country and the Democrats unify behind them. In this case, Bush doing pretty good at home in terms of popularity in the polls. And world conditions require now that he take a greater hand in the rest of the world. And since that's his instinct anyway, maybe my bleating about his being cautious and conservative and consultative and reactive will change some as he shifts into the stage of world affairs, and that he will be more decisive and more of a leader. That probably follows that we could hope that. Don't put up with all this stuff I'm saying. Okay, there's one. There you go.
You sound like you want President Bush or any United States president to tear up and say, let's go. Hell, we went through that with Hungary and Czechoslovakia, and we walked away from it because this country wasn't ready to pick up the responsibility. I wrote a paper in the National War College. You got a blue ribbon, the liberation of the satellite nations. And I'm damn glad to see what's coming to pass now. But for God's sake, keep the media quiet and stop putting our thumb in these people's eyes. I saw Tiananmen Square, and man, they all came home when things got rough. What I'm saying is, I think Bush is doing one hell of a job letting Gorbachev do the leading. That's where the leadership has to come from. We would go to make a reaction. Damn it.
I wanted to hear that's good. I wanted to hear Mr. Bush talk like that to me as my president. I wanted to hear him speak to the American people about the history of us in Eastern Europe. He's wonderful at it. He's absolutely magnificent at it. I want him to have some instinct to lead us. Now, if you expect me to stand here as some cartoon of the media, I can't answer you because I accept it. I'm a cartoon of the media. I'm trying to talk as an American citizen who wished that a president that I happen to be inclined to admire and like had not rushed out and done something dramatic. Someone said he should have gone and stood on the Berlin Wall. I didn't care about that. I wanted this country to be educated and inspired and reassured by its president in the greatest historical passage of my lifetime. I still do. And the fact that I work for a newspaper does not disentitle me to that wish.
I agree.
Do I have qualms about the reunification of Germany? The time has come for one of those fair warnings to consumers. And when you ask me about the reunification of Germany or any specific about foreign affairs, you would do as well or better to ask nearly anyone at hand. Yes, I am led to believe that we're entering into a period of the most complex negotiation, reaction, antipathy, worry in terms of the reunification of Germany that anyone ever did. Every country of Europe has its own view of that, most of it wary as hell. The memory of a unified Germany is perhaps the strongest memory any of us in the world have today. It frightens the hell out of people. It makes things terribly complex in terms of the Western European Economic Union, and then suddenly we're getting involved with these emerging countries from communism. Terribly complex, and qualms is all you see down the road. But I'm told that we best look at that in perspective, and that that's something that diplomats and patient people can deal with over a decade, two decades, and that it is not a Cold War with two countries at the point of pushing buttons at each other for 30 years, and that we just better accept this blessing but not assume it's going to be a maypole dance at all. It's going to be a tough time for all sorts of ethnic, political, and economic reactions that will make life very complicated. And that's not much of an answer, but that's all I can do. Yes. Sir, back
here. You were talking. Your immediate reaction was, this will give us more money to spend on social welfare and so forth. Not to reduce the deficit. Why not use that way?
You're absolutely right. Everyone agrees. Deficit first. Yeah, keep going. First, I owe everybody a correction about the deficit. There's nobody in Washington that doesn't agree that the first application of money goes to the deficit. Everybody agrees. That doesn't mean at all. I mean, Senator Mitchell, the Democratic leader, is the one who says, of course, the deficit comes first, but you begin doing these other things. The argument as to whether if we gave everybody that money, I doubt that severely. That's one of those nice sounding myths. One of the marvels of our programs for the poor these days is how little bureaucracy is involved in the food stamp program, how little bureaucracy is involved in most of the federal programs now. These are not great think tanks. These are people that they've stripped it down to computers, very small numbers, under in the Reagan years, starting in the Carter years. The amount of overhead money for people, for personnel, have been sharply reduced. We're not dealing in the poverty world with a vast bureaucracy now. We're dealing with pretty efficient distribution. And food stamps are one of the simplest things to distribute in the world. Those basic programs are running along, and they're not even terribly expensive.
I'm just thinking also of the money to house the poor people in the HUD program. And so much of that, instead of going into low-income housing, went into shopping centers luxury housing and things of that sort.
Did.
That's the kind of thing that I mean. You're wasting money when we put something that is designed to help the poor.
Well, we don't. We let the HUD thing just get crazy. I mean, the HUD thing's one of the great disgraces that we'll ever be involved in. That was just terrible. It involved mostly Republicans because they were in power. It even involved Democrats who weren't in power. But if you took all the HUD money in the world, you're talking such a tiny percentage of the defense budget and the Social Security budget. 47% of the federal budget is entitlement programs, dominated by Social Security, Medicare, and so forth. Every politician's afraid to touch them. That's 47%. 28% of the federal budget is defense. I here have added together 47 and 28. And you get 75% of untouchable money. Up to now. Then the fastest rising item in the federal budget is interest on the debt, your point about the deficit. Add that in, you're at 89% of the federal budget before you've gotten to anything you can cut. It's a sense of proportion is required here. HUD is in that 11% that's left. It's not a full percent. It's more like 0.3. Proportion, proportion, proportion. Ronald Reagan kept a wish list, and he sent it to Congress as a bill in about his third year. And it was 82 social programs that he thought could be absolutely eliminated. He may have been right about some of them. The Democratic Congress didn't eliminate a damn one. But he had 82 that could be eliminated. And they'd be very familiar to them as you look at some of them. Oh, that's that program where they help legal aid for the poor. Here's that program, they do this. He would have eliminated 82. The total savings of the 82 eliminations is $2.5 billion. The defense budget is $300 billion. I'm not saying the defense budget ought to be lower or that ought to be higher. I'm just saying proportion. We don't save much money by cleaning out all the bad bureaucrats. Wouldn't it be good to get rid of them? They're a pittance in terms of the financing of this government. This government's financial obligations are about defending our country in a complex world, and they're about care for people roughly the age of a bunch of us here. That's where the money is. In that little 11%, will you jam the whole U.S. government? And none of it amounts to much as to where the two great repositories of money are and the interest on the debt. Yes, sir.
What's going to happen to Mr. Lincoln's five hired guns?
Mr. Lincoln's five hired guns, five senators who all were constituents of the same guy. And they were all constituents. I mean, they were all, he had something in all their constituencies. I can't predict what's going to happen. I can tell you that there's considerable evidence that although they took large sums of money, and in two or three cases, almost unconscionable sums of money from a man, and then actually went to a meeting to try to represent his side, the evidence, preponderance of the evidence so far is that however disgusting that was. It didn't break a single ethical rule of the United States Senate. Now, it tells us a whole bunch about the ethical rules of the United States Senate. But if you've been covering politics as long as I have, all I can tell you is the ethical rules of the United States Senate are 20 times better than they were when I started. And they're moving. The ethical rules of the people who contribute to senators haven't improved that much. And those men deserve, were I some holier person than I am, I'd say they deserve some kind of public censure in virtually every case from the little I know about it. But I don't think it will be a heavy, it will not come down on their heads very heavily. There will be an investigation, and under the House rules, investigations are public business. Under the Senate rules, investigations are private. And if you were being investigated, you'd like the private idea. This is a non-judicial proceeding that just can smear you. But I don't know how that'll come out. My hunch is that the media will prevail, and they'll have to make those hearings, or at least have some sort of hearings that'll be public. But what you're really talking about is a world in which running for the Senate cost, when I used to cover Harry Byrd Sr. and Ted Dalton and all those good folks, a run for the Senate in Virginia didn't cost $500,000 or $600,000. Now, a run in New York didn't cost but $1 million or $2 million. And now Coleman and Wilder spent over $12 million. Television. Television, television, television. And PACs, Political Action Committee contributions, in the last decade have sextupled in size. Millions pouring in from the Keatings of this world and from perfectly decent people of this world that run associations and things. The trend, incidentally, of PAC money is give it to Democrats for Congress and get it through various soft money routes to Republicans for president and in legislatures and places. Democratic incumbents are being financed by the very same people who are financing conservative causes through PAC money. The cost of true television coverage is incredible. And I know many conservatives who say the only answer is to federalize congressional elections. Put up the money just like we do for president, put a limit on other contributions, and stop this insanity. But they won't say it publicly, because the conservative position publicly that seems to get support is don't limit our ability to contribute. American business does not want to be limited. Unions don't want to be limited. Business is where the money is. And so this is incredible gifts from the defense industry, from government contractors all over, are the lifeblood not just of contemporary Republicanism, but of many senior Democrats in the Congress.
Could we shift to the silent cabinet of Mr. Bush? But more specifically, perhaps I was the only one, but I was astounded by the power of the Attorney General saying that we cannot have
bothers us a bunch, and I can't answer your question. It hadn't bothered me enough that I've been in research how long they've been doing it. the check on attorney generals is the White House.
Can the president overrule
him? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The attorney general is responsible to the president. When the attorney general announces something on his own, it means he's cleared it with the White House, and they said, go ahead. Only once out of a million would he say something, the White House would step in and say, but that ain't what we're going to do. We learned a lot of that during the Nixon period. Attorney generals have the power to recommend to the White House, and if it suits them, to announce that they are not going to pursue a given prosecution. They're not, and because of national security is always the best gimmick on that. And so, no, if you're talking about what we don't know about Iran-Contra, we're not going to learn until more pressure is put on the Attorney General and the White House. And the assumption in Washington is that's an administration decision and that we shouldn't beat up the Attorney General too bad about it. And that with President Reagan still alive and well and a whole lot of people that were on the edges of Iran-Contra, and with there being a school of thought that anything you did was all right, better than what those damn Democrats were doing to try to block the flow of freedom in the world, or whatever, it's a partly political decision, and I'm sure Democrats have made decisions of the kind, not quite that dramatic that I can remember. But it's up to the president and his advisors, including the Attorney General, to make that decision. There's no legal standing in his having announced anything, except that he doesn't want to function. He doesn't want to do it. And what secrets there are, I don't know. George Bush might be able to tell you, well, here's what it would expose. I mean, someone told me one thing it would expose is three CIA sub-headquarters in Central and South America. I was told by the same person that unfortunately an American magazine's already printed where they are, but we don't need to just tell them again. Well, I figure the Russians subscribe to that magazine. You know, and then we wouldn't be telling all, but I'm just being a smart aleck. Yes, sir.
Can we now talk about what you said you really wanted to talk about? What's the thought down in Richmond about the impact of the recount?
I know the thought in Richmond from having talked to Paul Sonia, who talked to Jim Latimer, who said, no. The guess about the recount generally is that the odds would be very heavily against it reversing anything, but that there is an outside chance, an outside, I'm guessing 1 in 5, 1 in 6, 1 in 7, that there could, they could find a flaw when something is that close, something that went wrong. What is notable is that we have not had a rise yet, a cry that massive fraud was found in Dickinson County, or I just picked a county, it made certain people laugh. But, you know, we haven't found, when I was covering Virginia politics in the 40s, I mean, hell, you put into your guess about the thing how many votes would be stolen in Southwest Virginia. That was understood. You know, we've changed. We've gotten much, much better. But yes, you could find in a searching recount that something went wrong in some place. But it's not expected to happen. I just add that I think it would be a very severe event. In some states, and I'm being a provincial now, in some states I think to reverse an election and toss out the first elected black governor in the history of the United States, would be a very severe event that might cause trouble. I think Virginia has the most harmonious race relations that I know of in the United States. Not ideal, God knows, but probably the best all around. And I think we'd handle it. But what a sad moment it would be, and a wrench. And that puts Marshall Coleman in a very, very difficult position. But he's going ahead. Yes, in the back.
Do you foresee a contest for a spot on the national ticket, say by 96, between two ex-Virginia governors?
A spot on the national ticket contest between two ex-Virginia governors in 1996. On the odds, I'd bet against it. But of course you've raised the problem. I mean, a problem, but maybe a joyful possibility. I don't think there's any denying that anyone as young and well-organized and generally admired as Charles Robb who has a message for his party that he stands above all others expressing, which is get the Democrats into what Mr. Robb calls the mainstream and stop it from being this party known for its liberal kooky notions and its tax and spend policies. Charles Robb's going to become a major factor in the American Democratic Party. I don't know whether he can prevail and find a way to a ticket, but he will look like a compromise. I mean, I don't think he can be nominated for president in the near future, and you and I have watched a few vice presidents get picked because they sort of balanced the ticket, as the saying goes. And yes, a contender. As for Doug Wilder, once he's a former governor, if he's had a good record, he becomes a factor in national politics. But I would put Robb well ahead of him in the next decade of Virginians that I'm watching. Yes, ma'am.
There's been quite a bit of criticism of that kind of voting in South Carolina. Critics have said that they have accomplished much. They've been dealing with half of the voting, but others have been saving the
Well, I feel, first of all, that if you paid Congress by how hard they work, I mean, what they've accomplished is a terribly subjective idea, and I never would want to work for anybody that said we're going to pay you according to what you accomplish. Who's going to measure what I accomplish? I'm afraid that I'm a total convert to the side of Congress in this one. That's the hardest working bunch of people I've ever covered. I think the American misconception of the effort made by the Congress is hopelessly lost in Mark Twain and Will Rogers' influence on our lives and smart-alecky reporters and things. We're talking about people that work 14-hour days, 16-hour days. We're talking about some of the brightest people I've ever met in the United States as heads of colleges, industries, unions, whatever I've dealt with. Brilliant, caring people, 85%, working their guts out in a very difficult circumstance. As the world changes, as the problems pile up, as the president is now almost taken for granted to be of the other party, whichever. I'm an admirer of the Congress. I think its ethics are better than the ethics of any other group I can name, from my observation. I think its work is better, and I think it's the level of service and intelligence is incredibly high. Now, usually when I make that little spiel, I'm utterly disqualified from further credibility in any, by anybody. I've been known to disappear, just, but that's my opinion. And the idea that a bright young friend of mine, 2 years out of law school, can be making more than a United States senator is so preposterous. Senators, it doesn't matter as much because 60 of them are millionaires, 60 of the 100. But there are 40 others. In the House, there are plenty of people who went to college, did well, went to graduate school, went to law school, did well, got involved in politics early, have never really made much money. Have the highest aspirations for their kids to go to the finest colleges, are maintaining two houses, and raising three or four kids. And the idea that we cannot afford to pay them as much as we pay low-level executives in very ordinary business and newspaper enterprises. Come on, where are our values? What does it do for us to say they shouldn't make any money? I mean, it just awes me. It's the way to get a herd of second raters. We've got six Rhodes Scholars in the Senate out of 100. I think that's right, stage. The quality of the people there is marvelous. A lot of them could go out and make mints overnight. Bill Bradley could go on tour hooking basketballs and selling autographs. Working the year around, hard, trying hard to see them with each other is so marvelous when they're the good ones that you admire, and they're on both sides of that aisle. I just am so out of harmony with the idea of not paying them whatever's the going rate, a couple $100,000 sounds about right to me, for people running the future of the world. Suits me fine. I just have no interest. It cost me, I think, 11 cents to pay them all $500,000 a year. So we're not saving any money. We're working off that old American thing of you stick someone up on a pedestal, don't let them get fancy on you. There's some wholesomeness in populist America's view of politicians. Don't let them get to swaggering and taking on and driving those big cars. They're representatives of the people. That's fine. The same people elected Ronald Reagan and would still be electing him and would elect him in 2012 in advance if he were available. And he goes over to Japan, picks up $2 million for a speech fee. And if you asked him, was he setting a good example, he'd say, of course not. It was me. I wasn't setting any example at all. And he'd be vaguely right. But I just don't understand this notion we don't want to pay members of Congress. It bewilders me. We pay the head of the Fairfax County school system $125,000 a year, and you can't get a decent one unless you do. And it happens in the Fairfax County school system is a very good school system, one of the four best in the nation, we are told. Public school. I don't know anyone's upset about paying a guy $125,000. I know a lot of people that are upset about paying a congressman $89,000. We're working something off, some American thing. Maybe it's wholesome. I don't understand. Yes, sir.
Why won't Congress let the judiciary and the executive get their pay raise and then scrap for their own?
This year, they hadn't up to now, and it was a sheer tactic to try to get a raise. And they were holding a bunch of research physicians, and some of the best people that work for the United States government have been held hostage to a pay raise for the House and Senate. This year, the House bill releases the hostages, and the Senate bill releases the hostages. And the hostages, these people in the top layer of the hired personnel of our government, will get substantial raises. And this disgraceful gimmick they've used, I mean, I see it as disgraceful. They don't. They said we were doing anything we could do. We're turning the hostages loose and we'll pay them their money now. Now, as you know, the Senate has decided in its nobility not to take the same raise the House took. The Senate's taking a 9.5% raise with cost of living to come in another year, and it will continue to take the honoraria from the special interests and phase down the honoraria as its cost of living increases go up. The House did a clean, straight job, and anyone that doesn't see the glamour, if not the glory, of how they did it. They didn't do it like Jim Wright with some pompous speech and then was scared to go through with his speech and then choke. Tom Foley and that nice Republican leader, what's his name? Somebody say his name. Bob Michael went into a closed room and said, we're going to do it, right? And they said, right, and they shook hands. And they went out and they got their assistants and they brought their assistants in, and we gradually began to make rules. And do you realize at the end it had gone so far that if a congressman protested the thing on the floor, Lee Atwater's committee and the Democrats' committee was going to cut off his help at home. They went like real executives to get themselves a raise. And in the House, they brought it off beautifully. The radio guys, talk show hosts, were not even organized. They sleep, they don't read the New York Times. You know, if you looked in there, you could tell what was going on, but they kind of sleep through it. And then all of a sudden, they tried to rally their great host with a man I used to admire named Ralph Nader at the very head of a bunch of baying talk show radio hosts. But they were too late. The House had done the deed. And the House even did the deed in that marvelous, courteous way in which people who have really tough constituents, really tough crowd, those people passed. And then as the votes went up on the thing, they would confer with the leaders, and the leader would say, "George, you've been a good old guy. Why don't you go vote against this pay raise? We've got it, and it'll help you." And George, "Thank you very much." So we let George and Bill and Tom vote against it, yet they would have been there if you'd had to have them. And they brought it off with great skill, and I don't think they deceived the American people a lick. And I further think it will cost us as much as a penny apiece over the rest of our lifetime to pay for this raise. And I believe we can afford it. Have I gone on too long? They're not booing, but they're stirring. Can I read you a Ronald Reagan joke and quit? 1987, anyone got five, it'll take me 5 minutes, I said a joke. Anyone's got to quit, protest. I don't know why I want to read you a Ronald Reagan joke. See, I don't approve of him as a president. I don't like the deficit that he, and I do blame him heavily for it, because I saw Congress cut six of his eight budgets. Cut six of his eight budgets, and he says they ran up this huge deficit. Bull. He never submitted a balanced budget yet. And again, Congress cut six of the eight he did submit. He says they did it. Well, we all did it. Now, but I loved him personally. An authentic man that never pretended to be a single thing he wasn't. He was real, and he had a sense of humor about himself that will leave him in history. He'll be in history books for, one, having started toward arms control, and two, for having a sense of humor about the presidency and Ronald Reagan. All right, so we've been through Iran-Contra, which interests some of us here. The exposure of Ollie North rather registered in Washington. It didn't really out in the country, I don't think. But the president was embarrassed and to some degree disgraced by finding out that there was a whole nother government running in his White House, and we sort of thought he knew more about it than he was letting on. And he went into a funk, and Ms. Reagan mentions it in her book, I think, for about 6 weeks. He didn't have a press conference. He didn't have a public appearance. He just sulked. And we have this annual dinner of the Gridiron Club, which is newspaper people, the leaders of Congress, the president, the cabinet. They all come. And we make fun of them, and they make fun of us. And the president speaks at the end of the evening, usually humorously. Most presidents come to 2 out of 3 gridiron dinners. Reagan was there 8 years. He came 8 times. He made the funniest speech all 8. This is his text, and that's his own handwriting. It was the one speech he made a year that he wrote most of, put it together. Here he comes, then, at the end of 6 weeks of sulking about Iran-Contra, and the tension in the room was amazing. People kept looking, said, "Does he look sallow? Is the old guy finally getting old? And what will he say? And will this be embarrassing? Will he just sort of say it wasn't his fault?" Well, he went along and he said right at the start, "Ladies and gentlemen, I want to clear up something about this Iran mess, and I want to do it right here. When it comes to the question of whether I gave prior approval to the Israeli arms shipment, there are several possible answers. A, I did. B, I didn't. C, I don't know. D, I choose D, all of the above." Then he said, I do want to admit before this audience that we considered making one final shipment to Iran that you don't know about, but no one could figure out how to get Sam Donaldson in a crate." I'm sorry to tell you that anywhere you read that story, people laugh more than at any other thing. The White House was falling apart, disorganized. Reagan had to leave. Incompetence had sprung up all over the place. And President Reagan, with whose advice I do not know, maybe his own instincts, hired, I think, the best American politician of my time, one Howard Baker of Tennessee, to come in and run the frigging White House. Baker had been there 4 days, and you could already feel the place getting organized. Now, here's Ronald Reagan, here's the president of the Gridiron Club, here's Ms. Reagan, and there's Howard Baker at the huge head table. Howard Baker, known to every living Washingtonian and admired greatly. Now, the president speaking. Anyway, I know this Iran thing has raised some doubts about my memory. Just yesterday in the Oval Office, I was telling that man there. I said, Howard, my faculties are as good as they ever were. And he said, yes, Mr. President, that's what's worrying this country. Well, that's wrong. This is how he finished. Since I came to the White House, usually they finish with the flag and the Star Spangled Banner. I mean, they really go pretty far out to be patriots. And Reagan always did. Since I came to the White House, I've gotten 2 hearing aids. I've had a colon operation, a prostate operation, skin cancer. And I've been shot. And the damn thing is, I never felt better in my life. And this was his patriotic finish. I also feel good about this country because no matter what we come up against, we really are a resilient people. And as aggravated as I get, I genuinely think the press is one of the reasons we are able to remain flexible in this country. Our nation rolls with the punches, and those of us who represent the people can do no less. I meant what I said a few weeks ago. When you make a mistake, the healthy thing to do is take your knocks, learn your lessons, and move on. And he did take his knocks with remarkable grace and good humor. I scrawled across the top of this, without losing his faith in this country and its people. And he has moved on. The most conservative president in half a century moved on toward, of all things, arms control agreements and perhaps this new era of broader peaceful understanding with the Soviet Union. And that will be the historic and the ironic triumph of Ronald Reagan. Thank you all very much.